Hello, welcome to the fifth episode of Song Lab. My name is Evan Lanham.
And my name is Matthew Lane. This week in the Song Lab, we had Ryan Hickey of the rock band Fat Cat, the Pamela Parker Band, the Grateful Dead tribute band The 11, and writer and composer of the new musical Ox from the Stable.
We also get to hear one of his originals on piano at the end of the episode, so hopefully you stick around for that. Thanks for tuning in to Song Lab.
We are in studio with Ryan Hickey. Hello, Ryan.
Greetings.
How you doing?
Excellent.
Good.
Good to be here. How you doing?
Thanks for coming. I'm doing great. We're doing great.
We're glad you came. So we are here to talk to you about some songwriting. And but to start, let's talk about where you're from. Where were you born?
I was born on the East Coast, the Philadelphia area. Grew up there the majority of my life. Spent some years early childhood in Florida, but the majority in Philadelphia.
Cool.
And kind of grew up playing piano, classical piano.
Was your first instrument?
Piano was the first instrument, yeah.
And that started at what age?
Let's see, first grade, so you're 8 years old, I think.
First grade is 6 years old.
6 years old, is that right?
Yeah.
Jeez, okay. I guess I started 6 years old.
Okay.
You're so lucky.
Yeah,
you know, in hindsight, I really do feel lucky. And, you know, I was actually never smart enough to ever challenge my mom. You know, being a teacher now, I see these kids who get the option to play piano and their parents say, well, you know, we want to do what the kid wants to do. Luckily, I never asked that question of, hey, do I have this option? I kind of just did it.
There was no arguing.
I
don't want to practice today, Mom.
Yeah, there was just that was never even a question. And I don't think I resisted it too much. But at the same time, when you're that young, I wasn't like trying to be some piano player for the rest of my life.
Sure.
I didn't quite enjoy it, or I did not enjoy it. It was just something that I thought
you do
as a 6-year-old kid. Every kid does this.
That is lucky. That's very cool. Yeah, I mean, because everybody that I know hates it pretty quickly.
Yeah, you know, and actually being a piano teacher now, I get the same story in and out where the parents come and they say, save my kids' interest in music. And
right.
And to me, it's actually really simple being a teacher. I call it the smile factor. It's like if a kid is smiling, they're going to be into it. They're digging it. So all you got to do is... even if they're not into classical, you give them some rock and roll stuff that is built on classical riffs, classical fingering, stuff like that. You secretly get them doing the classical technique, and you just give them something that they want to do.
Yeah.
And they're into it. To me, it was always a simple formula. But back then, when you took piano, there was no, okay, let's play a Beatles song. Let's play, some pop music. That
right.
was never a question. So yeah, I guess in hindsight, I do feel lucky that I never stopped. There was a couple years I didn't play piano, but I was playing in the school orchestra, playing bassoon, playing French horn. So that kept my ear in music and kept me reading music. And actually, I remember when I got to elementary school in the music program, I think it first dawned on me that the rest of the kids had to learn to read music. And I already knew how to read music.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was something like you just learn the English language, you learn music.
Right.
And I remember scratching my head saying, wait, why are all these kids having trouble? Why do they have to learn how to read music? You know, so I was already at that point a little bit ahead of the game. But
That's
yeah.
also super helpful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. And so you switched to bassoon and French horn.
And French horn.
Why did you choose the...
You know what? We got an option to play any instrument in the orchestra, and I actually said... Everyone went for violin, trumpet, and I said, give me the instrument that is the weirdest, or maybe the hardest, or looks the craziest. I just wanted the weirdest thing, the most oddball thing. And actually, there was only room for two bassoon players... and the school actually only had two bassoons, or maybe three. But they're expensive. The plastic ones are, $4,000
right.
still. They're expensive piece of equipment.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was just like, give me the most craziest thing that I could get my hands on. And actually, I really did enjoy doing bassoon. So I only did French horn for maybe a year, and then bassoon for a couple of years in the orchestra.
Cool. And then you went back to piano?
Went back to piano. At the same time, you know, I was probably turning about 13, and you're getting into, you know, metal and rock and roll, or alternative, grunge, things like that. I was really into the Seattle music, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains, all that goodness stuff. So what you do naturally is you pick up the guitar, you teach yourself guitar, and Come As You Are was probably the first tune I ever learned on guitar. And after maybe a year of that, put a band together, us 12, 13-year-old kids. And
yes,
remember we did a Tool cover. We played some Green Day. And our band was called Ambergris, which we thought was really cool. But in hindsight, it's a terrible name because it actually means whale sperm. When you're 12, you think that's really cool. You think that's like the cool, you know, that's going to be a great name. There's the greatest rock and roll name of all time. Awful. But yeah, we had a logo, and we played a couple gigs. Our first gig was in the basement of a church who gave us the space, and it was probably horrendous. The sound was probably awful. We're probably all out of tune, but it was the most amazing. Yeah. We rocked it. We had a fantastic crowd to probably about, I don't know, 3 moms.
Sure.
Sick. But yeah, it was, you know, I think after that, I never looked back.
Yeah, that's cool. And that was, was that middle school or early high school?
That's middle school. So that was sixth grade. Okay. Yeah.
And how long? Right. Good for you guys. Way ahead of the game.
Yeah.
Was that all covers or did you guys start?
I think we did one original, but it was all covers.
Okay. Was that your original?
You know what? It was worked on. It was all of us. It was an Ambergris original.
Yes.
Ambergris original.
Do you remember the first song you ever wrote?
Ooh, that's a good question. I might have to take some time on that. I don't remember.
Do you remember the first time you sort of started putting licks and riffs, you know, just started coming up with your own, not entire songs, you know?
I think it was probably actually pianos when I started, when I got back on the piano and realized the prowess of the piano, that you could essentially write pop songs, or you could write songs that were built for full orchestras.
Yeah.
You know, the piano is kind of the to me, the master instrument, and you can handle all those tones and all the dynamics of a full orchestra, or you can write really simple pop music. And actually, the simple pop music is, I find it to be harder to write.
Yeah.
You know, I always say never confuse simplicity with easy. To me, to write a really good 3-4 chord song is tough. You know, you can hide behind the million other chords and jazz and orchestral music, but, you know, to have somebody walk away whistling your song, that's tough.
Sure. I mean, finding a catchy melody is a billion dollar thing, you know.
Uh-huh.
Paul McCartney's probably the best at it. And,
exactly.
You know, and
exactly.
We all know who that guy is.
Yep.
Okay, so... then you go into high school. What was your second band? Where did you
got into high school? Actually, I spent probably a year and a half, 2 years, really into hip hop.
Cool.
Which, as my generation, that probably seemed like a natural course. You kind of get into hip hop. But actually, even when I was doing hip hop, that actually made me. I wrote a lot. I wrote at the time they were raps.
Sure.
Okay, but it was, you know, you're writing poetry.
Yeah.
And you're working on that aspect of the whole songwriting element. So I wrote a lot. I had journals, I had books, and I wish I could dig some of those up. Or maybe it's the best I don't.
yeah.
But yeah, I was writing a lot. And then I remember it wasn't until I was about 15, I had some friends that were really into Led Zeppelin, really into Pink Floyd. And it finally clicked. I finally got it. And actually, at that same time, I went home and a Grateful Dead tape showed up in my tape deck. I don't know how, I don't know where it came from. I don't know how it got there, but it showed up in the tape deck. It was American Beauty. And I said, well, you know, what the hell is this? Grateful Dead. And it actually, when you, Grateful Dead sounded like a metal band name, you know, the skull and the whole thing. Sure. It seemed really, I thought it was going to be grunge metal or something. And I hit play and I was really perplexed. It was really unique, really peculiar music. And based upon my standards of what I thought I was supposed to like about music, I should not like this music, but I do. It was like really intriguing. It was I had heard nothing of it. And at that point, I found out they were some old band, washed up, outdated. And I went out probably within that next month, and I bought a live Grateful Dead four-disc record. It was, Barton Hall, I think, 74, something like that. And cool. I skimmed through the back, and I put on Eyes of the World, which I thought was the coolest title. And I said, holy shit, this is amazing. But it was my own little secret. I didn't realize that they were still going at it, and it was a... I didn't realize that the Grateful Dead had swept American music and changed American music and had such a profound impact on American culture. I thought they were old and washed up and all dead, and it was like my little secret. And at
you
night,
found this treasure buried in the music.
Exactly. At awesome. Night, I would put records on and I would listen to the tapes, and it was my own little secret. And I digress. It was at that point when I started realizing. I was getting into the Allman Brothers Band at that same time too.
Hell yeah.
So I started recognizing the similarities of, let's say, call and response technique in music. You know, the vocals would call, then I would hear this riff, and it would respond. So I started kind of filing my blues riffs and things like that, and I started understanding 12-bar blues patterns, and that's probably the point where I started putting together little bits and pieces of music and maybe starting to try and write really primitive songs or jamming on blues. And we would skip class and actually go to the band room for lunch, and we would jam, Hey Joe for 30 minutes, which sucked for me because the guitar players would just shred for 30 minutes.
Right.
And I was on a Steinway grand piano and not being heard at all, but it was still fun. So I think it was probably around 15 is when I started kind of piecing together, making attempts to writing songs.
Cool. And then did you go to college or anything?
Went to college for a year and a half. Actually, I went to school for fine arts.
Oh.
And I dropped out.
Yeah.
In lighter terms, I stopped going to school.
Yeah.
because actually when I was in high school, all I wanted to do was get out of high school. And actually I would skip school and I would go work with my neighbor. He was a contractor, and I would go make money. And because out of the group of friends, I was the only one who drove, and we would do road trips, and I was always driving. So I needed money. I was always about exploring and driving places. So, sorry, I got distracted. What was the question again?
where were we?
So you're in high school. You're playing. You started a band in high school?
I had a bit. Yeah, we did start a band in high school, actually. And after you get into the Grateful Dead, you get into the Allman Brothers, you kind of go the jam band route, which at this point in my life, I'm not crazy about. I probably wouldn't even consider the Allman Brothers Band or the Grateful Dead a jam band. But we did finally have a band. It was called the Gaia Experiment. And we were seniors, and we got this opportunity to play this festival gig. And I thought that was really cool. And it was actually with Vince Welnick of the Grateful Dead, one of the later keyboard players.
Yeah.
And so I set this whole gig up, and I promised the promoter, I was like, yeah, we're like this official band, and we put the steam behind us. And long story short, these guys all backed out, left me all out.
Your bandmates in high school?
Bandmates in high school, no. Exactly. They all bailed.
Wussies.
Yeah. Exactly. They all bailed. And that was actually, that was a big moment of kind of where I realized, like, just because somebody's good at playing music, because those guys were good. And I looked up, I was almost the new guy coming in, coming from the classical world into the blues world, you know. And I remember looking at these jazz piano players when I was a freshman and sophomore saying, how the fuck do they do that? How do they know what notes to hit?
Right.
How, those grace notes and those like trills and everything like that. How do they know? How are they making these decisions? I had this plethora of technique, but I didn't know the theory. I didn't know the jazz. I didn't know the, I couldn't make those decisions. So by the time I was, you know, a senior, I was starting that journey of making those decisions, being able to understand improvisation and composition and things like that. And I had always looked up to these guys who bailed on me, and I realized, wow, just because they're good doesn't mean that I have to align myself with people who are good, but who are also smart on. It was at that moment I realized that playing music is actually like a startup business. It's mm-hmm. actually, it's really a business. Playing in a band, I should say, playing in a successful band. Not to say you can't just sit on a porch and jam and play music without any business in mind. I absolutely love doing that. In fact, I probably don't do that as much as I should anymore. But it was at that moment when they all bailed on me and they left me out. I had to explain to this promoter, we're pulling out, we can't do it. And I felt really shitty. And I kind of made a promise to myself that I would always find people. Anybody can find a good guitar player, but to find a good guitar player who had the sense of building, you know, building a band is the tricky part. You know, that's
it is tricky, it's a gray area to talk about. I feel sometimes too, because running a band is running a business, but when you start talking about it too much, you know, you kind of sound like a weird sellout. Well, no, we're selling a product here.
Absolutely.
And you sound like a pencil pusher, and it's real. It gets rough.
Right.
But that's completely the case. If we're gonna make money at it, then it's gonna be business.
Yep. So, were you writing songs for this band in high school? What was the name again?
The Gaia Experiment. We did. We wrote some songs. They were really, you know, primitive at the time. They were great, but
you guys write them together.
Yeah, we wrote them together, and which means there probably wasn't enough. I was probably just playing rhythmic piano, not taking many solos or anything like that, but I actually remember at that same time when I had to bail on this festival, one of the biggest moments of my career where I realized, holy shit, this is what I wanted to do. At this time, I was already accepted into college. I was going to school for fine arts. At our senior class show, because nobody, I would always skip class, and at this piano was, I was almost embarrassed to be playing piano. I didn't let anybody know that I was a piano player. Only the guys I jammed with, I played piano with. But nobody really knew that I played piano except for a music teacher who I didn't have, but I would skip and I would go into his class because he had an open free period, and I would jam on the Steinway. And he said, hey, how about you do a number for the senior class show? Why don't you open up the senior class show? Why don't you play Doors, Light My Fire? You're shredding on that one. So I said, sure, you know, not thinking about it. Lo and behold, I went to a huge high school, so, and the auditorium was huge, raised theater-style seatings that sat, I don't know, at least 1,200 people.
Nice.
And huge, really wide stage, big, you know, 40-foot curtains. And I remember going out on stage, still not thinking anything. I'm behind the curtains. I hear the guy, welcome, you know, senior class show, class of 2003, blah, blah, blah. And the curtains open, and I see the whole full house. And I'm like, holy shit.
Uh-oh.
Heart drops.
Yeah.
What the hell did I get myself into? And so I played Doors. I said, okay, you got to do it. So I played Doors, Light My Fire. And I did this huge, you know, 2-minute, 3-minute improv solo like Ray Manzarek. And I got done, and the place lit up. Everyone stood up, cheered, roared. And I learned two things. One, I was really fucking nervous. Hmm. And I channeled those nerves into playing. So I realized, oh, being nervous is good. For me, you know, I was able to channel that. Two, I also realized I walked off a stage after everyone cheered, and I could, you know, my adrenaline's going, and I'm pacing back and forth behind stage, and that's when I realized that's what I want to do. That was one of the greatest feelings I ever had in my life. That's what I need to be doing. So for, you know, when I went to school for fine arts, it was almost like, here I am, I signed on to this whole thing, because you just, you know, like lemmings, you fall in line. Okay, you just go to college after high school, and right. You just you fall in line. And it ate at me. I wasn't doing much music at college. So eventually, you know, for lack of better terms, I dropped out. But that being a senior in high school, those two moments of when my band bailed on me and when I played solo piano in front of all those people, that's when I knew. I was like, this is what I need to be doing.
Yeah. And then how quick after that, at what point did you come to San Francisco?
So actually immediately after I dropped out of college, I started working, which is what I wanted to be doing, and I was making money. And my mom was like, "All right, you're not going to school. You want to be a room. You're out of the. You got 3 months. Get it together. Go find an apartment. Welcome." So I started working, but I started going to open mic jams. Long story short, this huge guy, I'll never forget him. His name is Ross Michael. Huge, probably 6'6", Rasta guy. Probably 250, 300 pounds. He said, "Hey, I'm playing in a touring reggae band. It's a Bob Marley tribute band. We need a keyboard player. Are you interested?" I said, "Sure." And they were just starting touring, and they were doing kind of the whole Eastern Seaboard, probably from Vermont down to South Carolina, out to Michigan. And I toured with them for 3 or 4 years. And that was a really important experience. That really built kind of my whole business background of the music industry. I started really listening closely to the guy who was doing the booking on our end. We also had a booking agent. So I really paid attention to all the business stuff. And probably after a couple of years, I took over it on our end, dealing with the booking agent. And probably after a year of that, I started getting these gigs that were better and more paying than our agent was getting. So I started kind of doing the full booking. But the guitar player and I at the same time started a funk band, and it was a funk trio. I was doing bass keys and organ. Nice. And we had a killer drummer, and we actually linked up with Pamela Parker.
Yes.
And we backed, she needed a backing band for some East Coast shows. So we backed her, and we did some really cool shows with her. And she said, "Hey, you know, I live in San Francisco. Why don't I can get you guys some gigs out in San Francisco?" So we set up this tour out in San Francisco, and kind of naive, but we played the 40th anniversary of Woodstock in Golden Nice. Gate Park,
yeah.
You know, 80,000 people, whatever it was there. We played Yoshi's, we played Boom Boom Room, we played up in Mendocino at the Shawnee, mm-hmm. Shawnee Pub. So here we are playing at, you know, these San Francisco staple, you know, Boom Boom Room, and San Francisco blew my mind, it ripped me open. And I said, "Oh my, I can't believe a city like this exists." And, you know, and at the time I had considered Grateful Dead my musical Bible. I had learned so much about songwriting, composition, instrumentation, American music, New Orleans music, polka, all genres of music from the Grateful Dead. So I was into the San Francisco scene, the band, Jefferson Airplane, the bands technically.
Right.
But when I visited San Francisco, I said, "Holy shit, this place is fucking amazing. I got to get back here at some point in my life. I need to be there." It was a dying urge to get here. But, you know, at the time, it's very pipe dreamish. You go home, and then okay, you had a great tour, you went out to San Francisco, it was killer. A couple years went by, and the Philly music scene is fantastic, but it just wasn't for the genre that I wanted to be doing. It felt like I was always pushing a ball uphill. So roads kind of all roads came to a closure in a good way. one including a female, right? So that was probably painful. But all these roads came to a close at one point. And what do you do when you you know, your band's over, you want to move on with your job, and you get your heart crushed from your girlfriend? What do? You move to San Francisco.
Sure.
I said, wait, this is what I was talking about. I, you know, 2 years later, I want to start over. I want to, I made a promise. I'd move to San Francisco. I have no debt. I have nothing. I have no kids. This is the time to do it. I'm young and advantageous and courageous and naive. Let's fucking do this thing.
Sure.
Sold all my shit and moved out to San Francisco.
All right. How old are you?
What was I, 26? 26 at the time.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's a good time.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we're talking, so now we're in San Francisco, and so let's talk about writing songs. What do you have a set process? I know, like, sort of to start, when we start, do you have a preferred environment in which you write in?
You know what? No preferred environment, and I kind of, there's a void. I like all music, so you know, I love actually playing the Grateful Dead stuff. At the same time, I love the New Orleans rhythms and the funk rhythms. At the same time, I enjoy writing kind of classical piano, and I really like Arabic rhythms and Arabic melodies and world music. So what I realized is I probably have different tactics to writing music in different genres.
Okay. So when you sit down, do you have a specific genre in mind? You're going to just try and bang one out in that way? Or is it, or do
you, you know what?
Does it come from the jam?
I want to say, yeah. I want to say I have a formula. And if I did, it would probably be easier to songwrite with.
Sure.
But I think it's different each time. And honestly, you know, I hear a lot of people say, well, I write chords first, or I write melodies first, or I write lyrics first. And I'm not doubting that that's true for them. But for me, I think what they're trying to say is I have success writing chords first, or I have success writing melodies first.
Right.
And what I realized is, how do you know you have success? Is that just your current comfort zone? Have you written 500 songs chords first and then 500 songs melodies first and have realized, okay, I have more success this way? I don't think many people do that. So for me, I think I'm going through that process of, if I do have a chord progression I dig, you know, I try and find a melody that goes for it, and then probably lyrics last. Or vice versa, I have this melody, or I'm off, you know, walking through the park, and this melody comes to my head, and you pull out the phone and you sing into the phone, you sing the melody, and then you go home at night and you pull it out and you try and fit some chords around it, and write that way. What I have been also having success is writing lyrics first, concepts first. And what actually liberated, I would always have problems writing lyrics. And what I found was I was always trying to write lyrics about myself. And that's really hard, because you can't, you don't want to lie, right? So, and there's, you know, when you're 25 or you're 26 or, you know, 29 now, it's not like you have this plethora of experiences. You haven't traveled the world six times around, and so how many things can you songwrite about? But what liberated me was, oh my God, I don't have to write about myself. Why don't I make up a character or write about somebody else's experiences? And when you make up a character, you can base it off of yourself, right? So you can actually have the emotional context of these are personal experiences of mine, but when it's not of yourself, you can totally Hollywood it up. You can make shit up.
Sure.
You can make the climax a lot more intense, so the resolve is a lot better. Instead of my little stupid experience, I can make it some epic story, some epic tale. Yes. That I went on. And that really liberated myself tremendously, is when I realized, oh my God, I don't have to write lyrics about myself. And so I enjoy writing about concepts, writing about, you know, things that people can actually relate to. We've all, you know, for example, here's 101, you write about, you know, your heart getting broken, right? But what else? You know, we all write about exploring, or, you know, exploring the frontier, or things that all humans, I think, innately want to be doing, answering questions about spirituality or things like that. So I, at this point, I really do enjoy writing concepts first.
So when you do that, when you changed away from the songs being about yourself, did the perspective change as well? So you started singing about he and her.
Yes.
Instead of me and my
exactly. Perspective changes, and you get into really you essentially start writing stories, and you're able to then write about what I actually enjoy doing is writing about the same situation, but two different perspectives of that same situation. Because there's always a million ways to look at there's always different angles. So yeah, to answer your question exactly, everything did change. You know, and I still write about myself now, and as I'm in the motion of songwriting, but half the time it's still based upon me or based upon my experiences, but sure, about a different character.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it definitely feels safer when, especially in a little coffee shop with people looking at you, to sing he instead of I.
Exactly.
His heart hurts, not mine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, playing music is one of the most intimate and challenging. I mean, you're literally ripping into your chest and putting your heart out on the table, and you're saying, okay, everybody, judge me.
Right.
You know, here I, and no matter what, no, if you're not, you know, for me to be upset about your opinion means I value your opinion. But when you're out there, you do value, because you're creating art. You've crafted these songs. You want good feedback. That's part of the process. And you're totally exposed. So when somebody says, oh, I didn't dig that song, or you're not getting the reaction you expected, it's maybe the story wasn't good enough. Maybe your story was lame, or maybe your song just wasn't crafted well enough. But whatever it is, you still are, you know, your heart is out, your soul is out on the line, and it's still very, you know, an emotional yes. process.
No, I agree. What do you think about collaborating writing? Is that easier, or is that a just completely different process for you?
Actually, it is easier, because if for example, I write really well when I have a bass player. For me, having a bass player opens up so many rhythms, and there's so many ideas that maybe I would eventually get to them, and maybe I would never get to those ideas. Maybe I would have never thought to bring that to the table. But the more people you have in it, I mean, I think there's a point of too many cooks in the kitchen.
Sure.
But I think it helps tremendously when you do have multiple people kind of offering opinions or offering ideas to one song, to one composition. I think that helps me a lot. Or I have written songs, and then I bring them into a collaborative space, and we rearrange those songs sure. based off of, you know. So I've written a bunch of songs for, you know, the funk rock band Fat Cat, but typically I'll bring those and we rearrange those, or maybe add an extra measure of this, or change the rhythm slightly of this to give it some more juice or more power, or put the hit in different places.
Yeah.
So for me, I think that's important.
Cool. And what projects are you, what are all the projects you're a part of now? There's Fat Cat, and you play with Pamela.
So there's Fat Cat, which fills a big hole in my heart. We do a lot of the New Orleans rhythms. We do the rock and roll stuff. You know, think Little Feet, with you know, Dave Combs, our singer. He's got some pipes like you.
Nice.
you know, he can do all the Robert Plant stuff, and he was a theater major. Did you do theater?
I did, yeah.
You did theater, yeah, see? You guys are cut from the same cloth. So he's great on stage, and, you know, he knows how to – I've always said anybody can keep a hot room hot, but to turn a cold room hot is – that's the talent, you know, and that's – he's got that. So that fills a big void. I play with Pamela Parker, which is unforgiving rock and roll, killer, just 70s style prog rock, but really modern and fresh. So that fills a big a hole in my heart. I play with, I have a Grateful Dead tribute band. We play with The 11. That's a lot of fun. And I also play with Stu Allen, doing a bunch of the Grateful Dead stuff around town. I also... I wrote a musical. Well, I'm probably still, it's still in the process. It's called Ox from the Stable. It was kind of, been speaking about songwriting, it was my first attempt to actually craft a bigger production than just music. So I wrote this whole story and backstories, and it's a hero's tale. And it has a lot of Taoism philosophy in it. So it has this very Asian... type of overtones, but it's very Americana, gold rush, east to west, finding yourself type of story. It's a classic, you know, hero's tale story. So, you know, I wrote all these parts, and we put kind of a primitive show together at Dolby Laboratories. They have a beautiful little theater there. It seats about 100 people with a beautiful Steinway grand piano. And got a couple singers, and we went through a bunch of acts and put a whole concert together. And at this point, I'm starting to sit down with actually the guitar player in The 11. His name's Clint Bajakian. He, in the interactive music world, the video game music world, is one of the godfathers. He basically, LucasArts was one of the first companies that said, you know what, we want orchestral music in our video games. And actually the bass player in The 11 too, were both, it was a trio, it was three guys. So two of them are in this Grateful Dead tribute band. But they're brilliant composers, and they basically put LucasArts on the map for music in video games. So he did all the old Star Wars games and Monkey Island and The Outlaws these classic video games, moved on to Sony and did a bunch, you know, Uncharted and all these huge games, and brilliant composer, did really emotional, I mean, this is world-class stuff. Recently parted ways with Sony, and he's working on the next World of Warcraft. So I get to hear all the new World of Warcraft music, and it's you know, it's world class. He's down in LA recording with live orchestra and choirs and everything. But he has what I'm excited about is he's kind of signed on to help me arrange some orchestration for this Ox from the Stable musical, I guess is a safe word to call it. That I've been doing, which is the direction that I originally had. I actually have this huge soft spot in my heart for, I love Disney music.
Sure.
And to me, actually, Disney taught me world music. You know, all you know, Aladdin, all the instrumentation in that is all Arabic, and the songwriting is very Arabic. You know, you look at Lion King, you get African instrumentation, you get African rhythms, you look at Little Mermaid, you get Caribbean music, Caribbean instrumentations, Mulan, Asian scales, Asian instrumentations.
Aladdin.
Exactly. Yeah. So for me, Disney taught me world music, and they taught me, you know, if I get a five-year-old student in on the piano, I play them a harmonic minor scale, and they say, oh, that reminds me of Egypt. It's like, you've seen Aladdin.
Yeah.
You didn't learn that anywhere else. I doubt the only reason why you know that's Egyptian, you haven't been to Egypt, is because you've seen Aladdin, you've seen pyramids, you've seen camels, and you've heard music with it. You've done the association. So, you know, when I wrote Ox from the Stable, it was very, you know, I had Disney as the platform, actually, kind of the cue orchestral. And I really wanted animation to go along with it, which is actually the next step as soon as I get the orchestration done. So, you know, there's that aspect of kind of the projects that I do. And, you know, I do some pickup things here and there, play with a couple other San Francisco artists. But sure, that's probably takes up the bulk of my time, and I try and keep it like that so I can focus on these projects. Don't spread myself too thin.
How do you even start that initial process of writing a musical? Like, where do you begin? And where did you begin?
That's a good question. You know, I think this actually all ties together in when I started realizing I don't have to write about myself. I actually subconsciously, when I, cause some of these songs that are in the musical are probably 10 years old, and they represent the East, the safeness of the character. And I wrote them in when I was safe. I was on the East Coast, or I was naive, and I had no idea about the big world out there. And I realized that I want to do productions more than just music. I want to do the whole thing. You know, I've always thought, why? Look how powerful just movies are. And a movie is you're taking. We have five senses, you know. We have sight, we have smell, we have touch, we have hearing. And movies only use two. It uses visuals and it uses sound, and they're powerful. They can change opinions. They can change. You know, they can dig down into people's emotions. So I had this crazy psychedelic idea of having all five senses, an experience where smells get delivered, things like that, and I'm sure that these ideas were really finely crafted late nights in a really fine state of mind. But I realized, okay, before I do all five, let me try two. You know, right now I've just been doing one, music. I would love to write scores for movies. Well, to get into that whole thing is, you know, it's all, you know, it's like breaching into any new scene. It's hard. It's political. It's a tight knit. So instead of waiting around, I said, fuck it. I'm going to do my own thing. And I'll just hire people out. I'll do it on my time, my schedule, everything like that. So I basically took a really simple plot line, a hero's tale, you know, kind of a Star Wars, a Dances with Wolves, an Avatar type of plot line that just gets rehashed over and over and over again, and you switch out a couple details, you make up your own characters, and I was really getting into scripts and movie scripts and learning things about what does the chorus mean? Where did that term come from? You know, it's a very Shakespearean term where in between acts, you know, the chorus would literally tell the audience exactly what was supposed to happen in this next act, because sometimes it was too poetic or they wouldn't understand. So the chorus and songwriting kind of derive from that same concept. You know, you have the verses, you're explaining it in really poetic terms, and then you get to the chorus and you just tell them the obvious, you tell the listener the obvious, okay, I love you, I love you, I love you. You repeat it, you know, you're telling the audience over and over. So I really started getting into figuring out what these successful movies were doing correctly. What did Star Wars do correctly? You know, C-3PO and R2-D2 kind of act as a chorus a lot of times. They tell the audience exactly what you're supposed to be feeling. Luke, don't go in that room. It's really dangerous. You know, they're telling the audience, you know, so I really got off on learning those concepts. So I said, fuck, I want to do this. You know, I want to, if I can songwrite, why can't I story write and write songs for that? And now you kind of get into choreography at the same time and you get into full productions. You know, I really got off on that. So I think it was probably a couple years of building my confidence and building that background, elements of what does it take to do a full composition, a full production, I should say. And, you know, then I probably spent another year completing the story. You know, I had the story for a while, But I realized that I needed more backstories, you know, because when you have really thick backstories, when those characters, when you have backstories to sub characters, the plot writes itself. When those sub characters interact with the main character, well, of course he's going to act that way because here's his backstory and this is where he is at this point of his life. So I probably took another year to write, you know, backstories and things like that. And at the same time, kind of putting it all together. So to answer your question in short, I don't know how or why. I think I just was fascinated, or I'm always up for a challenge, and I wanted to do something bigger than music. I wanted to do more of a production. So I said, fuck it, let me just take a stab at kind of writing my own big production here.
And probably on piano, you're writing that music,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Do you write down the notes, or do you just memorize the song?
I kind of, that's a really good question. They start very, okay, here's the form, here are the chords. Melodies start coming over, and you start repeating those melodies. And the more you do it, the more that the song becomes very finite. But in the beginning, a lot of my writing style is very organic, is very not played exactly the same way each time you go through it. But I think now with some of the songs, that they kind of solidify themselves. And I haven't scored out all these songs, you know, manuscript, but they're in the head.
Okay,
in the
all head. Right.
And some of the songs I am playing pretty close to exactly the same way, which was a big challenge for me in the beginning. But some of the songs now are kind of exactly the same way each time through.
What do you do when you get stuck? Do you get writer's block?
That's an excellent question. I feel I'm lucky that I love different genres of music, and so within one genre of music, if I get stuck on my musical, I'll go to another song. I'll continue working on that. But if I'm stuck on that genre, I just go to I go to Fat Cat. Start writing mm-hmm. in that. Maybe that's a sign of, and I always tell young songwriters, it's really, really important to be writing. You can't just sit down and write one song. You want to be writing multiple songs at the same time, because especially with young songwriters, you learn some new technique, you learn a new chord, or you learn a new rhythm, and you really want to force that rhythm into this new song. But the song that you've been writing maybe doesn't lend itself to that, and you're trying to force the issue. So if on the other songs that you're writing, it does work. So for me, it's important to be writing multiple songs in one genre, but multiple genres at the same time. I found that's a good cure to writer's block. But yeah, I think we all go through it, and it is really frustrating. Another really important thing that I've learned, it was actually, I heard it on an interview with an artist, actually. And the interviewer was asking the artist, what does it feel like to know that whatever painting you do is gonna sell for $500,000? And the artist, he was almost really offended. He said, do you think these 10 works you're seeing up here, you think this is what I've done in the last year? Just these 10? You know how many things that I've finished and thrown out, or halfway finished and thrown? This is the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
So what I've actually learned from that is I have to finish a song. Because when you're 20% done a song, so many songs I've crumpled up the paper and moved on after only 20%, because it sucked at that point. And maybe when you get to 100%, it would still suck in your opinion. Or when you get to 100% done, it's actually good. So I've learned to trust myself. You have to finish the song. Then you get to decide if it's good or not. Then you get to move on from it. For me, I feel like I want to finish it. Then I can crumple it up and move on. Because I've probably written more songs, not all the way through, than I have songs that are finished. And I've probably written a lot of songs and forgot about them because I haven't wrote them down.
Me too.
How do you document when you're writing? Do you write all your lyrics down initially as you're doing it? Do you kind of play through the whole song first as an idea, or
how spoiled are we that I take my phone out.
Yep.
And not only do I literally video record my face. So I have all the inversions, all the shapes I'm doing. So I get the audio and I get the video of what I'm doing. You know, and probably when I was, all the songs that I've forgotten were in the times when we didn't have phones and we didn't have things. And all you had was documentation, or you would bring your little, remember it was lucky if your tape deck had the little microphone thing on it, and you could get that blank or your ex-girlfriend's mixtape and just record over it. And just, you know, you pull it up and it's like some half-assed, shitty-ass recording, but you're able to record your ideas. You know, but at this point, it's like the new, I'm not scripting, I'm not scoring stuff. You know, I'll write the chords down maybe, but I videotape it at this point.
Cool. Yeah, technology is a huge help.
It's a huge tool.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Okay, so then to finish it out here, how do you decide, how do you know when a song is done?
Yeah, what doesn't suck?
That, I don't know if you have an answer for that. All right. Mean, there's definitely a point of, when you're in the studio, there's definitely a point of overdoing stuff. And I don't know how to find words to say when it's over, you know. I guess it's just that feeling you're looking for. I get, you know, that's part of that mystery of, nobody can put their finger on music. I mean.
Sure. I mean, well, because you could technically write a song and say that it's done, and even record it, and then it's pretty much almost in stone.
Well, you know.
But then you play it again for the next however long, and it keeps changing.
Here's a better answer. You know, teaching songwriting to young writers. I mean, if you look at what are the songs that have been successful, what do they all have? Well, typically, I mean, if you were to do it in black, a really simple question, a song has verses, it has choruses, and it has a bridge. You can get away sometimes without a bridge. A lot of punk music did that a lot of times. They just have an A and B section. You just go back and forth. For me, a bridge is really, really important. It's the inside section of a song, and it's going to point to the outer section of the song. It's going to make the outer section that much more emotional, and it's a relief from the rest of the song. It's contrasting to the rest of the song. Typically, if you're writing a major song, your bridge is probably going to be minor, or you know, maybe it's not that easy. But so I think I'm probably looking for these, you know, verse, you know, intro, verse, chorus, bridge, or an interlude, or a riff that you trip out on for a little bit. I'm probably looking for those sections. I'm probably looking for really interesting, effective harmonies. I'm probably looking for poetic lyrics that aren't your typical, you know, I try and not to write with base level words. I try and make it really effective. I use a lot of idioms. You know, when it rains, it pours. You know, a song, you know, I wrote a song called When It Rains, It Pours. It's a gospel song. And to me, that's an idiom. Everybody knows that expression, and it means something to everybody. So when you see that song title, it's like, you know what you're getting into. It's probably a song about somebody being all the shit just piling onto somebody, but then breaking through. So I'm probably looking for some poetic lyrics. And the arrangement to feel good. I want to build natural arcs within sections. I want to build, you know, I want the song to kind of not just be monotone the whole way. I want it to have some dynamics. I like to try different new rhythms in there, different drumming styles, different bass lines, things like that. So I think that's when I realize a song is probably done or ready to be brought to the band level, and we can start arranging it if I have all those elements kind of in place. And just because they're in place doesn't mean it's going to, sometimes you think it's gonna be a killer song, and you finish it, you get 100% done, you're like, well, okay, this won't be the single. It'll work on the record, but maybe it won't be the single. So that's probably a better answer.
Yeah, cool.
Awesome.
Good deal.
That was a great way to sum it up right there.
Yeah, I think I know how you write a song now.
Cool.
I think so.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming.
For coming.
Thank you. Thank you.